It is good to be back with you all. It's been almost a month. Actually, I think it has been a month exactly since the week I was supposed to teach this lesson before I left for Asia. The snow canceled our service. So we are now looking, as my dad said, at the book of Luke. That is lesson 5 in our series. And I'm going to present a lesson that is a month old. And I am still recovering from jet lag, so bear with me if something I say does not make sense. It wouldn't be the first time this week. So, let's look at the book of Luke. And as we read through this book in just overall study, I think a good subtitle to describe the contents is A Logical Defense for Jesus. And the summary is that Luke is presenting a carefully researched record of Jesus' life so that the Gentiles will recognize his absolute perfection. Now, Luke, by trade, was not a writer. He was a doctor, a physician. And as a physician, he was very thorough in his work. It's a good trait in a doctor. You want a doctor to take things into consideration, to be thorough in their diagnosis. So Luke was very well suited to perform the role of gospel writer for a very detailed account. As a Gentile, he was also well suited to address the specific concerns that Gentiles would have had when looking at the Messiah, at Jesus, from outside of Judaism. The theme, then, of Jesus' perfection and defending who Jesus is as a perfect man is continually seen throughout the book of Luke, and then he continues with his defense for Jesus and the events after Jesus' life in the book of Acts, which we will discuss in a few weeks. Who was Luke? Let's look a little bit more at the background for this author. He's a very important author. His two books compose a very large portion of the New Testament. Luke and Acts are very long, and they're very detailed. Luke was a Gentile. We say that from Colossians 4, 11 through 14. And we'll look at verse 14. He was also a physician. Colossians 4, 14. Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas greet you. So, he was a doctor, and if you read those first verses that we did not read just then, we'll also find that he is contrasted with several of Paul's other co-laborers who were Jews, and specifically members of the circumcision, he himself being one of Paul's co-laborers who were not Jews, or a Gentile. As a doctor, his interests in medical and medically related information are evident in his writings. He is careful to include details of healings that Jesus did that aren't included in other gospels because that was a special interest of his. But quite apart from being a doctor, the book of Luke and Acts and his writing style in the Greek language indicate that Luke was very well educated. In Greek class, when you start working through the different authors and you start translating, Luke's writings are some of the most difficult to translate because he has some of the most difficult style and very carefully organized thoughts in the language. So his writing is very well educated and would have been well accepted by people in higher positions in the government during his time. He might very well have been from the city of Antioch. There are a couple reasons we can say this. First, the early church fathers said that he was, and also much of Acts focuses on events in Antioch. So with Luke being the author of both Luke and Acts, he is writing a lot of events that happened in Antioch. So that is an interesting theory, and he very well might have come from that city. Who was Luke's source, though? So Luke, as a Gentile from probably Antioch, was not present in the land of Israel during Jesus' life and ministry. That means he had to have a source to record the information that he does in his book. He had several. The first one that he mentions himself is in chapter 1 and verse 3. And actually, I'd like to go ahead and have us all look at that verse, Luke chapter 1 and verse 3, because he lists several sources for his writing. Luke chapter 1, verse 3. Verse 2. Even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus. So he mentions eyewitnesses. As we continue reading, he mentions ministers of the word, who would have been people that were also preaching in the time that he was ministering with Paul. But as he joined Paul's missionary journey later on, he also would have found a good source in Paul the Apostle himself. Luke was a constant companion of Paul. He joined with Paul's team in Acts 16, verses 6 through 11. We see the transition in pronouns from they to we. And that indicates at the point when they were getting ready to go into Macedonia, and they tried to go north, they tried to go east, they tried to go south, and they were not allowed to by the Holy Spirit. Then they tried to go west when a man appeared to them in a vision and said to come and help them. And then that is where the pronouns changed to we. So that's when Paul joined. That's when Luke joined with Paul, and he stayed with Paul for the remainder of the book. He also returned to Jerusalem when Paul made his final trip back in Acts 21, verse 1, and he remained with Paul even later on during his imprisonments. We see that going on until perhaps the last book that Paul wrote, 2 Timothy, the end, chapter 4, verse 11. So by the end of Paul's life, Luke had become his only remaining companion, and the rest of his friends had deserted him, but Luke was still with him. As Luke traveled with the Apostle Paul, you can only imagine that he was continually sharing these events that he had seen. And then as Luke traveled, I'm sure he ran into more and more people that had scattered out from the land of Israel, with whom he could talk, gather information, and carefully research the writing of this book. So Luke had several sources. They were not his own personal eyewitness accounts, because he wasn't there, but he does use eyewitnesses because they're the most valid type of a witness for an event. Luke, the apostle, wrote prior to Paul's death. Given a time, we don't really have an exact date. The date I suggest at the bottom there is approximately AD 60. But these books were part of Paul's legal defense. And you say that because if you continue reading in chapter 1, verse 3 and 4, in his introduction, "For as much as many has taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us," skipping down to verse 4, "that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed." Theophilus was probably a ruler, a legal defendant in Paul's judgment. So these books of Luke and Acts were probably part of Paul's legal defense. It would be necessary to need a legal defense when confronted with the Roman Empire's hatred for Christianity. And we say also that the books were written before Paul's death, because the book of Acts does not mention his death, even though the second half is dedicated to following his life for the most part. Tradition says that Paul was martyred by Nero around AD 64. So If you factor in the second imprisonment and the first release, that leaves you with a couple years in there. We're going to say that the date of Luke was about AD 60. Just a second, having technical difficulties here. All right, so to whom did Luke write? I believe that's the next point in the lesson there. Luke is addressing Theophilus in both Luke and Acts. We've read the introduction in the book of Luke. If we read the introduction in Acts chapter 1, we also find that this is the primary person receiving this letter. The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to do and teach until the day in which he was taken up. After that, he, through the Holy Ghost, had given commandments unto the apostles whom he had chosen. The former treatise that the author of Acts had made was the book of Luke, and he mentions the division. The end of the first book is when Jesus goes up into heaven, and the beginning of the second book is the time after that, the expansion of the gospel into the known world. Who is Theophilus? The man who received both of these books, he must have had some kind of an important role in church history if he is the recipient of about a third of the New Testament. Well, he was evidently instructed in the ways of Christianity. We get that in Luke 1, verse 4. He had been instructed, and Luke was writing to him so that he might know for sure that the things he had heard were in fact true. He is addressed as a high-ranking official in verse 3. Most excellent Theophilus. That's not something that you would give to just Joe, common, ordinary man on the street. That's a title of respect given to somebody who had authority that you don't want to annoy because you want him to listen to your case. Some believe that he was a saved official in a Roman palace because the name Theophilus means lover of God. And that's what it translates to literally. Theos, the first half, is God, and philo, a verb from the second half, is to love. Lover of God. Others say he was Paul's lawyer in Rome, which that would probably be my first go-to answer because Luke's careful reiteration that his research is sound leads me to think that this is the most likely possibility, that he had some legal defense responsibility for the Apostle Paul while he was at Rome. Why did Luke write? He wrote to create a legally defensible account of Jesus' life. And that's a very important thing to realize because there are four statements from Luke in this introduction of how he had carefully researched his writing. It was perfect understanding. Apparently, there were a significant number of gospel writers, even in Luke's time. These large number of accounts were somewhat confusing. It might have had more truth in some, less truth in others. And for a man who was removed from the actual events to be able to sort through all the facts that he was presented with and know what was truth and what wasn't, he needed someone to give him an authoritative account. Luke was writing to Theophilus to create this legally defensible account. Perfect understanding shows, I think, two things. First, that he had worked hard to arrive at the final product he had written. And also, I think it might indicate that he realized he was being divinely inspired to write this book for a record of Jesus' life. The next thing that he says is from the very first. That shows he was trying to create a document that began at the beginning, which is a very important place to start when you're creating a record of a person's life, and that would continue until the present situation. In order, he was going to create a chronological account. Eyewitnesses. Again, eyewitnesses are the most credible kind of witness when you're setting up a defense in a trial. You want to know what people who were there actually saw. So those are the people he interviewed. Those are the people whose information he brought and worked into this account that he wrote. All in all, this introduction, these four aspects, leave us with a very good impression of Luke's ability to write and his authority for doing so. And a key theme, as he presents his purpose for writing and his desire in writing to defend Jesus, he is showing that Jesus is the perfect man. He shows Jesus' complete perfection and unjust death. The religious leaders, when they brought Jesus before the Roman government in Jerusalem, accused him of being a political nuisance, a political enemy of Rome. They weren't able to find any truth in that statement, but when a man is accused of being a political enemy, following that man's teaching, even if he's been killed, isn't a good way to stay friends with the government. So when people who were innocent were following Jesus' teaching, probably the best way to defend them is to clarify who Jesus really was, to clarify what he had really done, what he said, and what he taught. And Luke's point in his writing is that Jesus is a perfect man who was unjustly accused and killed by the Jews. To show this, he brings up a four-point timeline of Jesus' life. It begins with the early life of Jesus, which is about 30 years long, and it goes from chapter 1 until the end of chapter 2. Only two chapters are dedicated to these first 30 years of Jesus' life. That's not a lot. There's a very detailed account of the birth at Christmas, but there's not a lot of information about his early life. He continues on with Jesus' ministry in chapters 3 through 9. This covers about 3 years. So we've got two chapters for 30 years, six chapters for 3 years, and then in the next two sections, he moves on to the closing of Jesus' ministry, 3 or 4 months in 10 chapters, the last half of chapter 9 and chapter 19, the first half. And then he moves on to Jesus' death and resurrection. 8 days receive 5 of the last chapters of the book. So about a fifth of the book. So notice how the material gets more and more concentrated as you go on through Jesus' life. And I've said this as we've gone through the Gospels, which are biographies written in the Greek style. The Greeks prized and drew their opinion of the character in a biography based off of his death. That was what they wanted to see and understand when they read a biography. So it makes sense that Luke, who was a Gentile, well-educated in Greek thought, would emphasize the last half of Jesus' life, especially the events surrounding his death, because that's what people would want to understand. That's what they would want to know, but even those events leading up to his death are careful to point out that Jesus is not an enemy of Rome, but that he is a perfect man who was unjustly accused. Jesus' personal identity is the first point in the outline of the book. He begins with Luke's purpose statement, but after that it progresses on with Jesus' birth and relationship to John the Baptist in chapters 1 and 2. And then it discusses Jesus' youth. That's the story where Jesus is 12 years old. He gets left behind in the temple, but yet he's teaching the older people, the rabbis, the Pharisees, teaching them about God's word, and they're amazed to see how he has such wisdom. And then his parents come and find him. And then Jesus' baptism in chapter 3. John baptizes Jesus in the River Jordan. In the second half of chapter 3, we see Jesus' genealogy that proves that he is in fact a man. And Jesus resisting temptation. Now, remember, he's showing that Jesus is a perfect man. So to see that Jesus has refused the offering of all the world's powers, the ability to claim them all if he will only worship Satan, is a good fact to include here, because that would be something that most power-hungry people would ignore or would not ignore. They would have jumped at the chance to have all the world's dominions. And yet Jesus turned it down because he was not tempted by it. The next phase is Jesus' ministry beginning. And in this section, he works in Nazareth, Capernaum, and Galilee, and he calls his disciples. Luke is setting up the personal identity of the perfect man who turned the world upside down with his teachings. He was a human, but divine and immune to the temptations that most people would struggle with. This ministry, though, as he continues, is a compassionate ministry. The Sermon on the Mount is important for Luke's purpose because it showed Jesus' compassion on the poor and the depressed people of Israel. But the content is not subversive. Rather, it is focused on Jesus' command to love those who hate you and do good to them. That would be an unconceivable teaching for someone who is trying to take power. But Jesus' entire life demonstrated this principle, that you should do good to those who hate you and treat them well. Furthermore, there is nothing threatening about loving your enemies. And that is what Jesus demonstrated in his life. A nation full of people that truly love their neighbors and their enemies without distinction will be a pleasure to rule over. The kind of society that Jesus was teaching and instructing people to live in is not one that is rebellious or a threat to any government. He healed the people in and around Galilee. You know, the rulers always have the difficulty of dealing with their poorest citizens. They cannot be neglected. There's an enormous amount of power and enormous amount of will in the poor people in a country. But Jesus, if he was really trying to be the ruler like everybody else imagined rulers to be, would have tried to get them to fall in line behind him, to get them to support him and turn against their enemies to turn against Rome. But that's not what he did. Jesus did not try to take advantage of these poor people in Israel. Instead, he ministered to them with compassion and fed a crowd of them miraculously when they were hungry, making his actions completely different than what any ruler of the day would have done. That rulers should be above and untouchable by their subjects was accepted. But Jesus was not that way. He was honorable in his care for the poor. But he concludes this section by foretelling his death, which then moves on to the next phase of Jesus' life. His ministry expanding. He started in the area near his hometown. But as his ministry expands, he begins to take in other areas: Samaria, Bethany and Judah, Perea. In Samaria, although he was still rejected, he taught that one's neighborly responsibility transcends the boundaries of nation or race with the parable of the Good Samaritan. That was a paradigm shifter, to be sure. The Jews hated the Samaritans, but yet the hero of the story is a Samaritan who is loving his neighbor, even though his neighbor hated him. That's the kind of love that God that Jesus wanted his people to demonstrate. In the section around Bethany and Judea, Jesus taught about many more countercultural themes. Perhaps the primary one in chapter 12 is the evils of covetousness or the love of worldly things. Rulers typically seek to get things for themselves. Their palaces are lavishly decorated with pleasurable items. They live in comfort. They seek the best things they can get. But Jesus taught that those who lose their life will keep it. And those who try to seek the things of heaven will keep their life. Whereas those who try to get everything and keep their lives now will ultimately lose them. It was a totally foreign concept for the rulers in those days. The section in Perea is rather long, but it includes an important parable, the Minas, in which Jesus identifies himself as the judge of the earth, even though he is about to be killed. Now, you have to imagine the impact that this story must have had when presented as a document in a courtroom, because that was what the purpose of the document is for. All the important people are listening to the proceedings. They're sitting on their plush couches, drinking the best drinks, eating the best foods, relaxing, having a good time as they listen to this eyewitness account of a man with whom they were vaguely acquainted. They know about him, but they don't really know. They don't really know who he was. Then Luke throws in this story about the Minas. They know where the story is ultimately heading, that Jesus died. And yet, here, Jesus identifies himself as the judge. He says about himself also to the Jews who were getting ready to kill him, to reject and to kill him. It's a new side of the story, and the new truths that Jesus was teaching must have been convicting to the people who were listening. The book wraps up with Jesus' ministry ending, with the entrance into Jerusalem, which, if you remember from our discussion of Old Testament prophecy that we finished several months ago, we read about how there is actually a prophecy that says Jesus will ride into the city on a donkey, which is what he did. And then he was well accepted when he did so. In the next several days, he circumvented the religious leaders, doing verbal combat with them, where they tried to trap him in legal matters relating to their own government and the Roman government. If this was a point at which a Roman official could have looked at Jesus' life and accused him of some wrongdoing, that would be it. But yet Luke is careful to point out that Jesus was perfectly able to walk the fine line between truth and not breaking the governmental laws, which is hard to do, but yet when you're a perfect man who is accused unjustly, like Jesus was, it's completely possible. Luke is clearly pointing this out time after time as the religious leaders try to come and get him entrapped in some kind of a statement, but eventually they realize they're not going to win, and they convince Judas Iscariot to betray him at the Passover. And chapters 22 and 23 record the murder of an innocent man. And then, as Luke continued this story in this time, he is giving a very detailed account of the courtroom proceedings in the Jews' illegal trial, and then he continues with both Pilate and Herod's legitimate courts. All of them found no legitimate reason for death, except for a supposed blasphemy, which was only blasphemy because they didn't accept that he was God in the first place. So Luke is trying to really bring his point to a close here and say, people who are serving this Jesus are not breaking any law because Jesus did not break any law. He was found innocent in multiple courts. There's no reason that we should be accusing the man Paul, who is on trial, or any of these other Christians who are following him. And the book concludes with the resurrection in chapters 23 and 24. it ends with a miraculous event. And more specifically, the statement that the apostles and disciples would be witnesses of these events around the entire world. Thus, at the very end of Luke's book, we see the reason why Paul is in this position needing a defense. He's been obedient to the command that he has received from God, from Jesus. He has taken the gospel to all these places, and in the words of the people that were there listening to his preaching and the preaching of the other apostles, they've turned the world upside down. And now he's at a trial, being tried. The people want to know what it's all about. He's just been obedient, obeying the teachings of a perfect man who was unjustly accused. There are several important people in this book. I think you've probably seen them as we've gone through tonight's lesson. You have Theophilus, the recipient, Jesus, obviously the main character of the book, the perfect man, Mary and Joseph, who are his parents, the 12 disciples, Herod the Tetrarch. Now this Herod the Tetrarch was a son of Herod the Great that killed all the two-year-old babies in Bethlehem after he was denied by the wise men. This Herod was the ruler of Galilee and apparently had some bad blood with the other important ruler in Jerusalem, Pilate. He's the other important character. Ironically, Jesus' death was the factor that united these two men and brought them back to being able to communicate with each other on somewhat friendly terms. When they recognized each other's authority in jurisdiction, locationally, and they became friends after they both sent Jesus back and forth to each other, saying they couldn't find any fault in him, wanting to know who, what they would say. But as we've looked at this gospel, I think there's a very unique application that we can draw from it. And that is, respect the government because it is an institution ordained by God. We are all people. We see things that do not seem right to us in our government because no worldly institution is going to be perfect. The laws on our books may be illogical sometimes. They might be frustrating. But it is important for us as Christians to remember Jesus' example regarding the government. Remember, he always treated the government with respect. If he had slipped even one time, Luke's carefully defended life of Christ that he presents in his gospel would have been completely meaningless because people could have grabbed something that he had said and made him into a false teacher. But Jesus was always respectful of the Roman government, which is much worse than ours is today. And Jesus was still respectful of their laws. This is the only reason that Luke's presentation could have been accepted in Rome. The accusations at his crucifixion would have been accurate if he had failed even once. Paul wrote in his epistle to the Romans that they were to respect their rulers. Let's turn to Romans chapter 13 and read verses 1 through 4. Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. These people that were receiving this writing from Paul were smack dab in the middle of Roman society. probably being some of the poor people, they would have been at the worst end of it. And yet Paul tells them to respect the government and to live holy lives under the government, which entails obeying the laws as far as they do not go against Christian principles. There is never going to be a law against loving your neighbor as yourself, because that is something that all people want. They don't want somebody to come in and take their stuff. They don't want somebody to murder a family member. They don't want somebody to gradually move the fence line until they're taking over their yard. Whatever it might be, as long as you are respecting somebody else and loving them and giving them preference over yourself, there's never going to be a law against that. That's the point that Paul brings up. Do not let your good standing as a Christian become a bad thing when the unsaved see you willing to bend or even break the law when it becomes inconvenient. Inconvenience does not mean that the law is wrong. It's there and it's part of the government. I think of the time when Jesus had to pay taxes, and I don't imagine they had the taxes because he sent Peter out to the sea and told him to go fishing, to look in the mouth of the first fish. Peter might have been thinking, well, that's a bit strange. But he went out, caught the fish, and there was the tax money in the fish's mouth. That seems a little bit maybe inconvenient that you don't have the money, but yet they're asking for it. Inconvenience is not a point that you can bring up when trying to figure out whether or not you need to obey the law. What laws are there in our current government that we do not appreciate? Perhaps something like speed limit or texting while driving, or, you know, there's all kinds of things I could bring up, I think, tonight that just can seem like little inconvenient things, but yet they are part of the laws of our country. And if we're just pushing over the law just a little bit, towing the line, are we really obeying the law and honoring the government like Jesus would have done? There are any number of inconvenient laws, but the principle is still the same. Let's follow Jesus' example and respect the government because it is an institution ordained by God. Now, it is necessary, I think, to say that there is one time when we cannot obey the laws of the nation, when they are not aligned with God's law. Unfortunately, it may get to that place, even in America, where we have to be concerned about that, but this exception should not be applied lightly. It only applies when there is a definite biblical principle that is being violated when you obey the law. In that case, we must obey God rather than man. But nevertheless, our primary reaction to the government must still be respect if we would be like Jesus. So our application, respect the government because it is an institution ordained by God. That is our lesson tonight from the book of Luke, lesson number 5. Thank you very much for coming. At this time, let's divide up for prayer.